This is the brave new world.
Oh my gosh, it's been something that I've been trying to figure out. So, okay, yeah, you know, hopefully this sounds good, and we're both on, and we're both at a socially acceptable distance.
Yeah, I think miles plural is safe.
Though, like, it's weird though. We're at a social distance now, and just like 2 weeks ago, we lived in the same place.
Yeah, we were sharing a refrigerator.
It's good to hear your voice, man.
Yeah, you too. What have you been up to?
I've been trying to figure out podcast technology to record these things. I've spent a lot of time in that.
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of people on the phone, which has been good. Nice to like catch up with people that you wouldn't normally call. That's been I guess a silver lining of this. And grateful that people are answering their phones when we call for interviews for the most part. That's been helpful. Because if that stops, this is gonna be a challenge. So
hello everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post Dispatch baseball writer Derek Cool, joined this week by Ben Fredrickson, St. Louis Post Dispatch sports columnist. And we are at a distance. I'm trying to understand exactly how to cover sports when there are no sports, and cover sports when there is something far more important than sports. I want to ask you about just that, Ben. Take us through sort of the origin and then how you sought out your cake column from this past Sunday's Post-Dispatch.
You know, it's funny, like, this has been a curveball for us in our jobs, but, you know, as you do too, like, we both know people who are in the medical field and doing all kinds of in different phases of being on the front lines. And it's frustrating because you feel like you want to do something, but then you're like, I actually think the best thing to do is to just stay put. So how can we kind of maybe try to find a good balance of stories that matter? And, you know, you want to be on top of the news of this, but you also want to try to maybe offer up a pleasant distraction or a positive when you can find one. So kind of trying to figure out what the right tone is on stuff has been a challenge, but one that I've been trying to think a lot about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it all started when I was hungry. No, I'm kidding. I kind of have this idea of maybe occasionally kind of doing, I don't think I want to call it like a series because I don't know if it's that. It's just maybe a chance to take a look around and see people who are on the different forms of the front lines of this thing and see what their stories are. And if there's a compelling one, then tell it. I mean, we've seen some reaction from sports figures in our community. We've seen Adam Wainwright step up with a donation to minor leaguers and Dexter Fowler doing great stuff in Las Vegas. But I feel like the people who are really, truly, you know, battling this are the doctors and the nurses and the scientists, but also the people who don't get to stay at home. I mean, the people who keep the grocery stores stocked and are picking up our trash and delivering our mail. I mean, these people are as much in the mix as anybody. So I got I reached out to actually Dave Peacock, you know, who is, man, what an interesting time he has had in recent years, from trying to keep the Rams from leaving to now helping Schnooks navigate through this crisis.
Right.
And, he's got some stories to tell whenever he decides to do that. But, he actually put me in touch with someone who kind of, you know, I guess they're more or less their PR department. And I just said, hey, here's kind of what I'm looking for. So if you guys have something that jumps out, like, I'd like to hear about it. And we worked together to find the right person. And it happened to be Ashley Gilbert, this cake decorator in Farmington, who, you know, didn't do anything, you know, that you would build a statue of, but I thought did something in her everyday life that was pretty cool. She bought a customer's cake in honor of her stepdad on what would have been her stepdad's birthday. The cake was being picked up, and she said, hey, he liked this kind of cake, and I want to basically give it to you in honor of him. And this was, of course, in the midst of this first wave of the coronavirus kind of fallout on grocery stores, where everybody came
in. Oh, yeah.
And basically, you know, took every single loaf of bread in the building. And, you know, she's a cake decorator, but she was working to help unload produce and stock shelves. They were baking bread in house to help meet the demand. And she's been working, they all have been working like crazy. So I just thought that that moment was pretty neat. And Schnooks actually didn't know this. I found this out talking to Ashley, but she actually ended up knowing the person she bought the cake for, but not, didn't know it at the time of the purchase, which I thought was kind of neat. It was basically, yeah, her, you know, a distant soon to be relative by marriage that I thought kind of illustrated that, you know, we're all a little bit closer than we realize at times. So I thought it was kind of a neat story, maybe a little bit of a curveball. I won't probably be writing a ton of those, but now that we're open to new ideas and kind of all trying to get through this together, I think there is maybe an opportunity to go in some different directions a little bit.
Yeah. To maybe, you know, one of the things that, like when young writers, or even when I was a young writer, which I guess I no longer am, as you remind me, you know, they say, well, how do you cover a sport that you don't know? And it's like, well, all, you know, something about every sport, whether you realize it or not, you know, something about every event that you're going to go to, and that's how to write people. And so if you're going to do, you know, some kind of sport that's foreign to you, or some kind of sport that is a niche sport, and you're worried, well, do I know all the rules? Do I know all the play-by-play? Do I know all the history? Do I know all these things? Like, say, we know by being baseball fans or being college football fans or being boxing fans for most of our life. Well, write the people. Just go and write the people. Don't get bogged down in the rules you don't know, or the history you don't know, or the strategy you couldn't possibly get because you can't learn it in the time that these people have devoted their lives to doing it well. So write the people. You know, I had to cover an offshore speedboat racing once, and it was like, I don't even know how fast these boats are going, let alone how quickly they zoom by me from one horizon to the next. So you go out and you talk to the people. And, you know, one of the guys told me about the boat that the speedboat, I don't even know what the name of it should be, but the name that he gave it was Zero Defect, because his point was, if any screw or nut or bolt was loose, the thing would come apart at the speed they were racing. And so I thought, well, that's pretty profound. I'm going to write about the person who gets in that, you know, metal tube that skims on water at a frightening velocity. So write the people. And that's essentially what you're talking about, is in a time of crisis, when there are no sports, practice writing about the people.
And I think on top of that, I can't agree more, but also it's a chance for us to maybe write a little bit about the people in sports more. I mean, we always try to do a good job of that, of going beyond just the X's and O's of what happens in a game, and try to get everything from analysis to opinion, but also who are these guys and what makes them tick. And I think that's a challenge now too, is it, there's more of an opportunity probably to get at what makes someone who they are and what motivates them. And, you know, we can't sit down with them from, you know, across a table for the time being, but, you know, you can get what you can off the phone and make a lot of calls. So it's just kind of trying to change your angle a little bit at times. And, you know, we have to be willing to adjust and adapt. And, you know, I do think, you know, we've gotten awesome messages from readers thanking the Post-Dispatch for continuing to put out the sports section and seeking out sports stories. And I think we're in a spot where we have to, you know, our job is to cover the news of this and how it affects sports, but it's also to, you know, to uplift, to inspire, to make people think, to continue to do the things we do every day. But, you know, we have to, you know, we owe it to our readers to try to find sports related stories until there aren't any left. And the thing is, there's always going to be some left, and there's always going to be really good ones. And this shouldn't be a reason for us to shut up shop or to shut things down. And, you know, it's a little different, but we got to go find them.
And one of those ways that we can do that is by bringing them a podcast like this, where we'll continue talking about baseball. And we will, right after I tell everybody about our sponsors. Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design. They're at 314-733-9855. That's Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, your official sponsor of the weekly best podcast in baseball. And this past week, Ben, was not without baseball news. There was a couple baseball players doing, you know, along the lines of what you mentioned, where Dexter Fowler is giving matching support to a food pantry there in Vegas that is helping with people who are hungry, who may have lost their jobs, who may not have access to food. He is matching other donations going to them. And then you had Adam Wainwright, closer to home here in St. Louis, who donated $250,000 to Cardinal minor leaguers through two different charities, but specifically earmarked that money to go to Cardinal minor leaguers to help them out at a time when they would, as of today, still be receiving baseball per diem during spring training. This whole stoppage of play, especially coming in spring training, has maybe awakened people. What's the word there? Woke would be the word.
Yes, stay. You're supposed to stay woke. That's 2020 version of
that. Okay. So this whole stoppage has pulled back the curtain. Let's use that phrase. Pulled back the curtain on how players are not paid during spring training. That includes major leaguers and minor leaguers. They receive a per diem. You know, the major leaguers has actually gone down in the recent years. And the minor leaguers, it might seem like a pittance when just put on like kind of a number, like, you know, the $25 or $50 or however you look at it. But know that it does not include meals per se, because so much of the meals are provided by the team at the facility. So the teams can control the nutrition and you know, teams pay the chefs and all this stuff. And that was something that the players wanted, particularly the players on the 40-man, the players represented by the union. They wanted chefs there, and they wanted access to food and to better food and to more food. And so the per diem went down to cover that. So here we are, and at a time when, you know, when minor leaguers would be receiving some housing fees and the per diem, and three squares a day at the ballpark, now they don't. And also there's seasonal employees who maybe won't be able to get a job at a time when we saw 3.3 million, you know, apply for unemployment. So it's really put a sharp focus on the situation the minor leaguers have to deal with. Major League Baseball's, you know, the Cardinals said that they were going to pay out the players for their per diem. Major League Baseball then came out the next day over the top of the Cardinals and said that every team will give more to the players in a lump sum, sort of a cash infusion that was more than the Cardinals originally presented their minor leaguers. And then you have Wainwright adding to it with the $250,000. Have you, you know, what has been your feeling of this? This is something you and I have talked about for a while. You know, a year or so ago, I did a story about John Brebbia and Ryan Sheriff and their and how they had to deal with, you know, the low wages of independent ball and minor league ball and moving around and really trying to limit expenses until they got their major league salaries, and then how they had to partition that and like how it meant sometimes they would have leases in different places because of promotions and had to cover those. Do you think that this has that greater awareness of that might be the fallout from this time here, more people understanding what wages are actually like for professional ball players?
Well, I think there's more attention being paid to the lifestyle and, you know, income factors of a minor leaguer now than ever before. It used to be, you know, one of these things that was not talked about or thought about, or if it was, it was almost kind of in a, well, that's the way it is kind of way, you know, the pay your dues, shrug it off system. And if you don't like it, leave.
Right.
So, you know, my understanding of it has grown over recent years. I still have, I never quite understand the people who have made this their like sole battle cry. Because I just like, for me personally, and I hope this doesn't sound, I hope this comes across the right way. Like, there are so many causes that are worth pursuing in this country, in this world, that to me, like, what minor leaguers get paid is not like, it's not cracking my power rankings. And it's not that I don't care about minor leaguers as people. I don't, that's not it at all. I do. but I also like, to me, for all the things that baseball ownership spits out, that is oftentimes just makes me want to bang my head against the table. The comparison that, that compares minor leaguers to the same entertainment industries, I actually kind of understand. I mean, we're not going nuts about the people who are, playing, open mics in Nashville who want to be the next big country music singer, and they're not getting paid a livable salary. And they don't, unless they make it. Should more be done for those people? You could argue, sure. You could argue that more should be done for any people who aren't making livable salaries. And I would support that. But the notion that it's, I think where I get hung up is no one's saying, hey, the only way that you can work in this country is to be a minor league baseball player. There are a lot of people who've played that game as far and as fast and as high as they can play it. And they reach the point where, hey, it's not for me. And if you feel like you can make a better living doing something else, then it's probably wise to, after a certain point, pursue that as opposed to waiting. But until that decision is made, and for a lot of guys who, are going to reach the major leagues, or guys who are close, then it makes sense for them to get a little bigger piece of the pie that baseball produces. The other thing that should be mentioned here, and this is something that I think gets lost from the discussion, it has become very easy to bang on Major League Baseball about its treatment of minor leaguers, but no one ever bangs on the players, because it's like as soon as they transfer from minor to major leaguers, it's like they get that Men in Black like brain eraser treatment where they forget that they were minor leaguers. And that's why, it's really cool to see Adam do what he did. Because it's acknowledging, I paid my dues. I know what it's like. I remember. Because a lot of guys, when they make that transition, it's like they forget all about it. And they don't want to stick up for the minor leaguers anymore. They don't want to bang the table for them because they turn into the crowd that, quote unquote, paid their dues. So while this is a topic that has generated a lot of conversation, I think it's certainly a good thing to address. It doesn't make sense for baseball to make as much as it does and to have the guys who feed that system living 3, 4, 5 men to a house because they can't afford, to have one roommate and a full refrigerator. I'm with you on that and with anybody who supports that. But I'm also not quite ready to turn this into the biggest injustice of all time. However, the question you asked was, is this going to direct more attention and discussion? And I think it will. And I think we're seeing players as the focus in baseball shifts to the younger crowd. I think we're going to see more guys who are closer to that time in their life who maybe are more willing to speak up and stick up for those guys.
Yeah. I worry that, the concern is that a lot of businesses are not going to survive this, right? Whether it's restaurants or some shops. I mean, I see that in my own neighborhood here in St. Louis as to how they adjust to a new norm for many, many weeks ahead. Or how they don't think they can. And the question is, will they ever come back? And I do worry that we'll see that in baseball too, is, there's the other bit of news that happened in this past week was the agreement between the Players Association and the owners and what a shortened season would look like, what a canceled season would look like, and some of the ramifications thereof for players with salaries and, service time and things like that. And also how late the season could go and how they'll try to get as many games in as possible and what that looks like for a World Series in a cold climate and what adjustment they might have to make there. But there was already conversation about shuttering minor league affiliates, ones that didn't have the facilities or had too much travel cost or just felt like was part of this minor league bloat. And, there were more than 40 teams that Major League Baseball were saying, we should do without. And, the other side of that, the cynic says, well, that's cutting jobs out and they want to raise money, but they're not going to raise salaries for minor leaguers, but they're not going to raise the amount of money given to minor leaguers. They're just going to raise salary for some and then basically lay off the rest by closing out these affiliates. And I worry that's going to happen now. It's going to kind of be forced upon them as opposed to negotiated or discussed. Is there'll be teams, leagues, whatever, that may not be able to come back from this. There may be some minor leagues that don't play this year? And will that show that baseball goes, okay, well, we can do without them and we don't need that? And I worry, I think in the long run, that would be a detriment to the game because it would take away its grassroots nature, its community nature, its, you know, its baseball is always accessible no matter where you live. You can't say that about other sports. You know, it's not, you know, wherever, like, what was the closest, the Royals would have been the closest team to where you grew up, correct?
Yes.
So, and was there a minor league team that was close?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, like we would have, so Liberty Park in Sedalia, where I grew up, had been built during the works project. So there would be like summer wood bat leagues and
oh, things. Oh, well, like, yeah, great.
Where we played high school baseball. That's where we played Legion ball. And then, you know, there would be, you know, like as of now, they're like the Sedalia Bombers, summer wood bat league team that actually Luke Voigt played on for a period.
Oh, really?
For a period of time. You know, so there's, and God, I don't even know what league or what level that is, but it's not a minor league team, but you're right. It's, there's always one of the things about growing up in certain parts of America is you're always probably a 10-minute drive away from a baseball game of some consequence.
Right, right. Was, I mean, I grew up 22 minutes from AAA baseball.
And I get that. I mean, there is the sense of community there is pretty special. However, there are also places where that team is not being watched and that team is not a pillar of the community. I imagine for most places that you say, hey, losing this team would really hurt both in terms of the quality of life in the town and also the, you know, the economic health of the town, you can probably point to another team or two that's not really moving the needle in either of those ways. And baseball has said those would be the ones that it, you know, basically it said we're not going to go out and uproot successful, thriving teams, but ones that are not able to, you know, to make good business, they would be interested in perhaps doing without. Now, the question is who defines that, right?
Right.
And the other question that's being discussed here is, if they actually do act on this, would be who defines what these state-of-the-art, what these modern facilities are? Because that's been one thing baseball said a lot is, you know, we can't have our minor leaguers playing in places that are not fit to play in. Well, what does that really mean? And who's deciding? Because what something is, if there's rusty nails in the fence that are stabbing the center fielder every time he goes back to the wall, then okay, I get that. If it's the fact that, you know, it's not, doesn't look like a major league facility, then I don't really know if those are realistic expectations.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that'll be something that, you know, I'm sure Major League Baseball will want to define. You know, the teams will be, it'll be real interesting, you know, what they're willing to do. You know, the Cardinals run two Dominican Summer League affiliates. You know, they also have two affiliates at their spring training facility. So whatever upgrades they make to the spring training facility, they'll, you know, want to keep, you know, and use for teams. One of those affiliates is a GCL team where they don't sell tickets for games. And so that allows them some flexibility when it comes to rehab assignments or appearances, you know, for 40-man players and things like that. You know, it doesn't start the clock on, say, a rehab assignment. So that has value because they can get in a competitive situation, yes, against a level of play that, you know, is significantly a few steps beneath theirs, but still it's game action as opposed to just live BP or rehab stuff. And they can control those games. If a guy wants to go down there and is on injury, is on the injured list and wants to get multiple at bats, he can lead off the first four innings, get four plate appearances and be out of there by, you know, the fourth inning, or can just get, you know, eight plate appearances in the first two innings. So I don't know, you know, our team's going to want to bring those in house and just kind of have these inter-squad games. I don't know. There's a lot of questions, but as baseball, just like every business, adjusts to life after the coronavirus crisis, it could lead to a natural attrition of some of these teams that baseball was already looking to. And maybe you're right. Maybe it's survival of the fittest then at that point with baseball and everything. I think there'll be an element missing from even the existence of these lower level games and the yeah, I'm a romantic, fine, but the magic that creates of whether people go there or not, but this notion that there are rungs on the ladder, you take those away, all of a sudden that climb doesn't seem as long.
Well, the climb already isn't as long. And I think that's right. Part of what has to be factored in too, right? I mean, when you've got players like Dylan Carlson, Dakota Hudson, sure, too. He's like, what, 25?
Yeah, they sped through. Yeah.
So when you've got these guys, you know, when Juan Soto is hitting cleanup for the Nationals at age 20, then I don't know that you need as expansive as a minor league system. You know, part of what we're seeing, I think, is an adjustment to the aging curve. And guys who are ready are there so much sooner now and proving they can hang. Not only can they produce, but they're so much cheaper and teams love that when guys are flying up the ladder faster than ever before and skipping rungs left and right, then it eventually the ladder is going to shrink because all those rungs are deemed unnecessary. And I don't mean unnecessary in terms of what they provide, not necessary for the development of elite baseball players.
But you might get fewer late bloomers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what happens to Luke Voigt?
That is definitely the downside. You're right.
You know, and there's another part to this, too, that is the sinister part of that, like young players getting here earlier and earlier. It's because they're cheaper. Like Juan Soto is an extremely talented player. Acuna, an extremely talented young player. They're, you know, Bryce Harper, an extremely young, talented player. But there's also some young players getting to the majors now, you know, to populate bullpens, to populate the bench, to be a slightly above replacement, you know, value player. And the reason why they're there younger isn't because they're ready for that role and or better than a veteran for that role. It's because they're of a greater value for that role. And that's been one of the real issues that baseball, I don't know if there's an answer for it, but if there is one, the union is certainly looking for it. But for teams to start making decisions based on who the best player is, not who the best value is. And, you know, people can point to the Cardinals and sure, but there's a lot of teams that do that where, you know, they'll be like, all right, well, we got a guy who is a second year player who's going to make slightly above the minimum. And let's say he's a 1.5 war player. Or we could go get a veteran who will sign for 10 times that much and be a 2.5 war player. Was that one extra war worth the $4.5 million? You're going to get a better player for that $4.5 million. Maybe it depends on what type of team you are. It certainly depends on what type of revenues you have. It definitely depends on how competitive you think you'll be. You factor all that in. But in the end, teams are making the value play. And so players are getting there younger. They're developing service time quicker. They're being ejected faster because that kind of value wears off in year three of arbitration, possibly. Maybe year two if they're not starters. And at the same time, it's costing veteran players jobs, because they have to recalculate, even though they're the better player. And that's the math that is really problematic for baseball, and it represents a huge obstacle for them to get over in their discussions. Now, maybe this past week, you know, as they come to an agreement on things, maybe this sets the table, as you have written about for STLtoday.com and the Post Dispatch, you know, for some kind of meeting of the minds in the long run. Maybe the necessary agreements they have to come to now in a time of crisis makes them better tuned, more harmonious when it comes to the labor strife that is expected ahead, when it comes to, you know, the expiration of the CBA, maybe. But I still think that, you know, that is going to be one of the big issues, one of the big fences between the two, is this notion that owners are making decisions based on player value, not always best player. And the union is going to want the best players making the best money. And how do they bridge that gap?
I think the first thing you do is you try to find a way to close the gap between the best and the value. And you do that by letting younger stars who are producing, like the highest paid veterans, you know, you meet them make in the middle money. And let them make more money. So those calls are harder to make. And
yep.
the other thing would be, you know, you have to actually have the players fight for their best players to make the most money, because
right.
their stance in years past has been the most proven players or the most tenured players. And,
right.
and that's not happening anymore. They can argue for it all they want, but it's, you know, it's at some point you're arguing the flat earth theory. I mean, the owners are not going to sign up to spend bad money. They spend enough bad money when they're trying to do it smartly. Right. They're not going to say, oh, okay, well, we listened to you. We'll start paying, you know, we'll start giving big contracts to 30 plus year olds again. They, you know, baseball has shown that that's not a wise investment. There are certainly exceptions. But I think the players should focus on finding a way to make sure that they're getting that the money that's drying up in the proven veterans is being distributed somewhere. And that's kind of, I think, what we're talking about here. This conversation with the minor leagues and with this, you know, whatever conversations will be had for the next CBA are so much related. You're talking about the shrinking of the major league lifespan, if you will. If 30 plus is now quote unquote old, and again, there are exceptions, but if that's going to be the kind of industry trend, then you have to kind of have some reorganization here about what this timeline looks like. If more and more guys are going to be deemed as ready or their value is so great that they're getting that opportunity when they're much younger than in years past, then there probably doesn't need to be so many rungs on the ladder before they get there, because they're not going to be used. But then once they're there and once they're Jack Flaherty, the best pitcher on the team, then how do they become compensated more fairly based off of what they're actually providing? Complicated discussions. And I think this negotiation about what this work pause looks like was going to be a really interesting just kind of litmus test on how those conversations could go. And maybe not on those conversations, but just on the stance of the sides. I mean, if they were just at each other's neck so much that they couldn't get along with anything, you know, it's kind of similar to our political leaders in this country, mm-hmm. then we would not have seen this move as quickly and as efficiently as it has. So I think there is some positive there. I think baseball realized, owners and players alike, that now is not really the time that either wants to be portrayed as bickering at one another. You've got people losing jobs and unemployment going up, and people are worrying about how they're going to pay for their next, you know, mortgage payment. They don't really want to hear about baseball players and baseball owners fighting about millions and billions of dollars. It's kind of a turnoff. So I think both were smart enough to realize this, and hopefully, you know, we talked about it before we left Jupiter. There's really only two ways this time will go. And it's either going to help these sides get closer together, or it's going to drive a bigger wedge between them. And I think hopefully this is also reminding them, as Adam Wainwright said, what it's like without baseball and how no one likes it, which is a good thing to keep in mind when you're debating a CBA.
Great point. Yeah. Yeah. Were you at all surprised or intrigued by some of the agreements that came in? Specifically, I wondered what you thought about, because you're right. So many of the decisions the union make is on paying your dues, right? Like, free agency comes after 6 years, and the market has always been, well, then you get somewhat paid for your production to that point, and the new team, you know, kind of shoulders it. Well, not anymore. Were you at all then, like, intrigued by the notion that service time was such a priority and salaries were treated a little bit differently in these agreements?
Well, my first takeaway was that the owners, I think there's at least some degree of legitimate chance there won't be baseball in 2020.
That was my first
reaction, because they fight service time tooth and nail, and they're kind of probably in theory reluctant to upfront a bunch of cash like they did. But, you know, in order to make those concessions, the players agreed that they won't be able to sue them for full salaries if their season's canceled, which is $4 billion+. The owners stretched that point, to me, made me wonder what they're hearing in their conversations that we're not hearing. And what are they talking about? What are their numbers? What are their projections saying? What are they getting from, you know, high level conversations they're having with health department leaders that are not going to be public knowledge, at least for the time being, it makes me think they're at least a little concerned about it, probably more than a little, else they would not have taken that stance. So the players, I can see why, feel like they got a good deal, and that service time I think was right up top of their list, as it should have been. It could get pretty weird if it plays out that way and, you know, they don't end up playing. I mean, then they might feel like they got swindled a little bit. But, you know, again, this is going to come down to trust between both sides. The owners taking that stance, to me, made me wonder what they know. That was the biggest thing that I had. And because we know how much they were against, kind of just how much they are against in general, the idea of fidgeting with service time at all. It's not something they like to do. And now it kind of sets a precedent. Well, you did it here. Why can't you adjust it in general when we're talking about 2021?
You can see it seems that the stage for it. Yeah, yeah. Certainly sets the stage for that to be more agreeable. I think it's interesting at this point where the owners don't have any revenue coming in, right? Salaries would be money going out. Service time costs nothing today. Yep. It costs down the road, you know, but then it costs once games are being played again, and then they kind of adjust. But as of today, when they have no money coming in, basically no ticket sales, none of that revenue coming in, service time costs them nothing. That was the kind of thought I had. I do think it sets up for some really interesting spots. You know, Mookie Betts, will he ever be a Dodger?
Yeah. So much for that series, right?
Right. And what happens then? How do the Dodgers feel about that trade? You know, what do they have to do? Do they have some kind of claim to say we got no benefit from this? So should they, you know, kind of rewind history on the trade? I don't know, you know, but there's a definite sense of like, okay, if there isn't a season this year, Mookie Betts becomes a free agent by agreement because he has his service time. And does that mean that he was ever a Dodger at all? To, you know, closer to home, it, you know, with Jack Flaherty, he'll get a full year of service time. It will make him arbitration eligible, right? And then, you know, he would have a platform year of his past year. And what kind of money would he get? Well, he wouldn't be able to add on to that. And he would have missed a really important year when he's healthy. And that's no small thing for pitchers. So, you know, I think that's a really interesting thing. But it also, you know, like on the way inside baseball, it also speaks to like some of those moves the Cardinals have made, right? They optioned out Alex Reyes. Yeah. Well, does that mean Alex Reyes wasn't going to be on the opening day roster? No, he might have been on the opening day roster, but now there's not going to be an opening day roster. We would already know what that is. They would be preparing for their home opener. But because he's now in the minors, you know, if there's no season, he's not on the major league roster for the entire year of 2020. And he would get the amount of service time that he had in 2019, which would still keep him delayed from arbitration rights. So you can see how some of these teams are making transaction, things in buildup towards that agreement being in place and then rosters being frozen and no trades allowed and things like that. It just was an interesting backdrop It was an interesting kind of agreement that put such an emphasis on service time and accommodates some salaries, but left a whole lot of salaries likely off, you know, not to be paid, because the longer this goes, to your point, in reality, and this cannot be stressed enough, I've seen a lot of people trying to guess as when baseball will come back. I know that it would be really fanciful and wonderful and grand, and trust me, I hope that this happens, that baseball returns with the All-Star game at Dodger Stadium. That would be grand in the middle of July, and, you know, fanfare and the best players and, you know, just everybody happy to have the game back and one of the best stages and the biggest crowds in a big city and all of that. However, every time we think that way, we should offer up an asterisk that, like, baseball doesn't control the timeline. Baseball doesn't know when it will be back, because baseball has no say in that. the virus has a say in that. That's what will determine that. You know, the governments will determine that. The governors will determine that. And so any guess as to when baseball is coming back is going to be wrong, because baseball doesn't have control over it until there's a break, until there's a downslide, until there's control of the virus. Because until then, there's not going to be crowds. And until then, they're not going to be 50 people together. And that's what it'll take to play a baseball game. And, you know, I just think that it's a little misleading, because, as you say, the owners know something, or maybe the owners know something that they're not saying publicly. But the answer is out there in the public. It's the baseball can't determine this, the virus will.
Well, and I think to double down on that, some of the language that's coming out of this agreement should make people a little less optimistic about when this can get up and going again. I mean, they're talking about not having games until, you know, it's cleared by, you know, ramming home the point that what you just mentioned, that it's not up to baseball. And it seems like in some ways above and beyond, they don't want to be viewed as a league that's pushing the envelope in terms of risking health to get back out there. I mean, the players have concerns about really being an all clear to me, which is going to move this timeline back. I guess I'm the negative Nancy. I don't get the point of having an all-star game when there's no way to pick decent all-stars. I mean, me, it's like the point of the all-star game is to reward people for, and the best part about the all-star game in my eyes is the guys who we didn't see coming, you know? And so those guys are not in it now. I mean, I don't know. I get
we just kind of grin and bear it this year.
I don't know why game. I don't know why players and owners are so obsessed with this idea of getting as close to 162 as possible, which Manfred has obviously said is not possible now, but they still want to play as many. Right. Why start off with a game that doesn't count?
I mean, no, that's all fair. That's all fair. No, I totally agree. And I think it's fanciful. Like I said, I mean, it's overly, you know, it's what WP Kinsella would write, but I just think that like people want to latch on to, you know, it's just like what the players tell us, right? Like I talked to Colton Wong, or you talk to a pitcher, and you and I both heard it from theirs. They want a date to shoot for, and without a date to shoot for, it's such a different thing. They want a goal line to push through. They want a deadline to be ready.
Yeah, everybody does.
So everybody's kind of grasping at it, but nobody has one. And that's your point, is the owners, you know, they recognize that they don't have one. And the owners recognize that they don't have control of when they will get one. And that should be alarming. And that should also be revealing, not just for baseball, but just for, you know, how long you and I are going to be doing this podcast without seeing each other.
Let's do the podcast until baseball comes back. Marathon.
No, we have to stop to write at some point in time. You know, Thursday of the week that this podcast drops, the Baltimore Orioles were set to be at Busch Stadium for an interleague series and opening day, the grand opening day, tied for first, as Tony La Russa would say. My father asked me the other day, because he saw a little story on opening day in St. Louis, and he said, you know, I've only ever been to a few opening days. He could recall going to the very first game there at Mile High Stadium in 1993 with the Rockies. That was not a season opening day, but that was the first Major League Baseball game played in that time zone with 80,227 people there. So a big deal. But he said, you've seen a lot of opening days. You've seen them in different places. Does St. Louis truthfully stand out? And I can truthfully say it does. The only one that I've the really only two that I've experienced that have come close, and one is Cincinnati, which is where the Cardinals would have opened this year. Cincinnati does a heck of a job. Civic Holiday, as I talked about in the previous podcast with Seacher and Rosecrans of The Athletic, you know, just all the history that they pour into it, you know, it is right there. And then I've seen a couple opening days, or one opening day in San Francisco where they had a championship to honor, and that was an amazing opening day. But you know, the Cardinals one is special, for all the reasons you've had a chance to see, all the Hall of Famers in their red blazers, the parade, the gathering downtown, but not just stuff that happens at the ballpark, but stuff that happens in schools all over the area and hospitals and law offices and everything all over the area where, if you're not wearing Cardinal stuff, you stand out. If it's not a civic holiday, it is the peak of civic pride. And that makes the day just so special and a reminder of what we won't have this weekend. What will you miss about it? What is something that you hope to see or that you like to see every, is it the Clydesdales?
Definitely. It's the first first of many trips in the season to the Ben and Jerry's ice cream stand. They keep moving greater distances away from the press box every year, I think in attempts to spare our health, but it's not working.
Right, to get us exercise.
No, it's seeing what the prices of the stir-fried noodles on level 3 have gone up to.
Doubled in price.
Seems like $35 this year. No, okay, I'm serious. To me, this has been a reminder to never, ever, ever take for granted the daily routine of baseball. And there are times, and I'll admit this, where it's like, man, we spend a lot of time here, and I'm not there nearly as often as you and Rick, so I'll preface that, but it's like you go to the game hours before the clubhouse opens. The clubhouse opens hours before the game begins. You talk to the manager before and after every game. There are 162 games a year. I mean, covering baseball it's time-consuming, and it's every single day. And there are days when it's like, man, this is crazy, kind of. And then it takes, nothing makes you appreciate the dailiness of it like the absence of it. And to me, that's what this period has really been about. And I can, I wasn't here, for in 9/11 when, we had the return of baseball, but I have talked obviously to people who were there. You were there. I mean, you read about, the poem that Jack Buck read, and that was what Tony LaRussa stands out to him. And he compared, what will eventually be opening day at Busch, the home opener, whenever it comes, to that moment, in that it will be basically a sign that we're getting back on our feet, a sign that St. Louis is ready to get through this. Now, I guess the question would be, Derek, and we don't have this answer, no one does, what would it be like if that moment came and fans aren't allowed in the stadium?
Right. I was just going to ask that. Does an empty stadium take away from that?
In some ways it has to, right? I mean, that's so much of what that moment is the sea of red and the cheers. And I mean, you can literally see
the history, community,
the history being passed down from family members as they tell you who the story behind those guys in the red jackets. I mean, you can see it happening, and it's a living, moving thing. So, that's what I'm curious. I think that will be probably the biggest news on when we start to get a real timeline on when this comes back, is whether or not they're going to try to play this without fans. And if they say, hey, we're going to wait because it's not baseball unless there's people in the seats, the Marlins might object. But I do think that's going to be a huge deciding factor here.
Yeah, I wonder if that isn't the way to do it. Like, I wonder if coming back and playing before empty crowds is counterproductive, because it shows how the emphasis is on playing the game no matter what, and not on how the game can be something that reunites a community. I wonder if games played before empty stadiums are more haunting and reinforce what we've just been through and a continuation of it versus a packed house that would symbolize the end.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the answer ultimately will probably boil down to what it tends to boil down to in large scale American sports, is what's the best financial move for the league. I mean, right. I think if they feel like they can play a lot of baseball games, and play them a lot sooner if they play them in front of no fans, then I think they will probably try to figure out a way to do that and put them on TV. Because I understand, a significant chunk of revenue, like up to like what, 30% comes through attendance, but 70% is better than none. And you better believe the rates and the all the kind of money that could be made on broadcasting those games would be exciting for the league and its partners. To have something live on TV to watch is going to be intriguing to people, whether it's played, you know, in front of no one or a bunch of people. So I think that's one thing that is the conversation shifted. It used to be if there's no crowd, there's no game. But we've seen that change. I mean, guys do college basketball broadcasts from studios now.
Right.
You know, this is a different time frame. So I'm with you. I think it would be it would certainly dull. Even if you played games without fans, then it would probably significantly dull that feel of, hey, we're back, if you just rolled out, you know, waited until you could roll it out with fans. But I also think, you know, we probably put more emphasis on that vibe, that feel, than the people who will be making that decision do. And I'm not saying they don't think about it. They do. But if they can see a sheet that says this is how many games you can play. And I'm not talking about just the owners. I'm talking about the players too, because everybody makes money when games are played. If you see a sheet that says this is what the revenue is for everybody when the games are played in front of nobody, and we play earlier, and this is what it is if we wait until we can have full stadiums, and there's a big difference, then I think they're going to take the one that makes the most money.
Yeah. There was an article from over in England about the Premier League, and, you know, the discussions going on about what do they do with their season. You know, do they declare Liverpool champion, or do they say this is an incomplete season and thus Liverpool does not win, even though they're well clear of the field, do not win, and continues their search, you know, the first title in what, 3 decades or so. So a big, you know, big part of history there, especially given, you know, just the history of that league. And, you know, the article in The Athletic talked about how an official said it was morally wrong for football to even be discussing playing behind closed doors while the coronavirus crisis is at its peak. And this notion that, like, it's wrong to have something as frivolous as a game going on while there's something as serious as a global crisis that is costing lives. And I think, you know, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, you know, we understand that. But I read this and I was thinking too, like, is there also a moral element of playing in front of empty seats? You know, sports exist, some more so than other, the Packers, for example, because of the fans they have. Sports exists as entertainment. You know, sports exists as, you know, here in St. Louis as a public trust. And is it wrong then to play just on television? Is that a breach of contract because it's supposed to be a community event? And, you know, what got me thinking about that is in the Premier League, you have quite literally neighborhood clubs, you know, that were soccer clubs that have share identities, despite how large the stadiums have gotten and how much money has become at stake, that represent either pockets of London, neighborhoods of London, or groups of people or cities, Liverpool, you know, that there's a community aspect to that. And if you say we are going to go on without the community, we're going to play these games without the community present, is that feel right? I don't know. I mean, I just think it's an interesting kind of discussion. Is it sports without fans, or is it just, you know, a reality TV show?
Well, I'd be curious to see a fan vote on if they could not see baseball until baseball comes back and they can be in the seats, or if they want to see it where they can watch it from their couch.
It's a great question. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for it.
I feel like a lot of them would say, hell yeah, I'd like to watch a game. I don't care if I can be there or not. I would love to be there, sure. But yeah. I'd rather have a game being played than not, period. I mean, that would be a fascinating, you know, thing to get a good read on. I don't know what it would be. But
I don't know either.
I wonder if it would. I just know that, you know, as I've been covering sports, we have, I think, been, you know, so trained on focusing on attendance and how many people are there. And that's kind of how our brains work, because we're there. And, you know, when people, when 10 people don't show up, it's like, oh, where are they? But I do think as dominating as broadcasts and live streaming have become, and their niche and the power there, that I oftentimes feel like, you know, maybe we're not putting enough emphasis on how many people that reaches and how many people prefer to watch it that way.
It's entirely fair.
I don't know. I mean, it's a great theory. I'm sure to some degree, the people who have the power to make these decisions are having similar conversations.
And really, I wonder, I
would be curious to see, you know, maybe we can roll it out in chats, you know, and see what kind of feedback we get of what people would say about that question.
Let's open it up to the community here at the BPIB. I mean, let, you know, tweet us, you know, hashtag BPIB. You and I are going to pick winners on that thing. I know that that did not go as smoothly as possible. In all honesty, I was able to get some packaging today. I put the books aside, and I got the right packaging, so I can mail them anywhere now, and maybe now's a good time. So you and I will pick a winner of people who are listening to the podcast at the most scenic or more creative places. So we'll do that, and I'll get those in the mail so that people can receive them here during the time of quarantine. But let's open up this question, I mean, to folks on Twitter. Then, you know, we have a community here. It's one of the best parts of the best podcast in baseball. You know, is this group that comes in and tells us about listening and, you know, has really been able to sustain this podcast because of their interest in it. And now we have a sponsor because of their interest in it. So we'll open up to the community. Would you want baseball back, even if it's just on TV in front of empty stands? Or to you, is the crowd part of the game and baseball shouldn't be back until there should be a crowd there to experience the game, you know? And then hashtag BPIB with your answers and your reasoning. I'd be really fascinated to hear about it.
Yeah, I'm curious. I don't know. And I wonder too, you know, what it would look like. It'd be crazy to see the answers broken down by, are you in St. Louis, out of St. Louis? What's your age range? I mean, it's a very interesting theory that I would have to imagine the league is doing some sort of investigation on itself, I would hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have plenty more to talk about and plenty more podcasts to fill. So we will have other episodes in the coming weeks to discuss pitching depth and pitching moves and, you know, what the Cardinals will look like when they come back. And of course, news will continue to roll out here. You know, throughout this time, what do you think would have been the lineup for the Cardinals home opener Thursday had they played? What do you think the lineup would have been like, and who the starting pitcher would have been?
Well, I think we had pretty much figured out the lineup, hadn't we? We had Colton, and then it was we had Carpenter probably.
Yes.
Paul Goldschmidt, and correct. Then Paul DeJong.
Correct.
And then go with it.
Yeah. Well, and then probably Tyler O'Neill in left field to start. And
yeah,
then
Tyler would have had the first shot. Dylan Carlson would not have been there, which would have upset a lot of people.
Would not have been there. Would have been probably T-minus 10 days and one slump by Tyler O'Neill or Lane Thomas away. Then you would have had, Tyler O'Neill would have bat fifth. You'd have Yadier Molina sixth, unless he had moved up to fifth. Then you'd have Dexter Fowler, likely seventh, Harrison Bader, eighth. And then who would have been your opening day starter?
Well, I'd have to, now you're putting me on the spot. I didn't have that figured out, because Jack would have obviously been the starter. Would Jack be ready again? Because he would have been, how many games would have happened? Not have been.
No, six games would have happened.
Oh, now you're going to make me pull up the schedule. Hold on.
Yeah, six games. It's just you don't have to think too hard about it. It would essentially have been the game two starter.
I bet they would have given it to Wainwright.
They would have given it to Wainwright. I have to imagine they would have given him the ceremonial start there.
Yeah,
that would have set up. It would have set up for a Flaherty Wainwright Martinez series against the Reds, possibly. And then you'd have Hudson and Kim Flaherty against the Brewers, and then Wainwright coming out you know, for the home opener. That seems to make the only other possibility would have been Hudson as a nod to his season last year.
They would have I can get that. But Wainwright at home, yeah, I could. I think you'd probably go Wainwright there.
Well, you maximize his home starts that way. Yeah. You know, you get him two starts on the home stand, and also you get a guy who's well versed in it, and you got a guy who it might be his last season, and that's you know, that is part of this here. The you know, what happens with him? You know, if they lose a season, does he come back again?
Well, yeah, I mean, if the rotation is because we thought we had pretty much figured it out. You know, Miles was going to be the guy who had to get healthy, and then when he came back, saw which wheel was loose, and there's a discussion, right? And now Miles can be healthy. So the six-man competition for the rotation, you know, that who goes, who stays, who gets first shot is back on between Carlos and Kim. And I think it's, you know, again, of all the people that this is frustrating for, you got to put Carlos Martinez up there because he had been so locked in, so healthy, so
correct
so in spring. And now it's the question that you have anytime Carlos has time away from baseball is what's it going to look like when he gets back? And, you know, he's talked about that, and, you know, he was so dedicated this off season with his workouts. It's like, okay, now there's this new wrinkle in it, and it could open up a whole another can of worms.
Wow. Yeah. And you're right, how they react to it. Well, next time I have you on, I'm going to ask you to tell us a baseball story. So prepare for that. It can be your favorite baseball story. It can be a baseball story you've heard from someone else, or you can just take one of my baseball stories and retell it to me.
My least favorite baseball story, you know that one.
I don't know that one.
I told it on the radio show.
We had a radio show?
Yeah, I thought we were going to do a writer's block reunion on one of these podcasts.
We might. We might do, we have time, so we'll set it up. But I just want, tell your worst baseball story. That'll be a tease for the next time you're on.
I want to tease it. Yeah. I want to tease it to the archives of the writer's block. It was about how I was like the fourth string backup catcher, and the starting catcher.
Oh, I know this story. No, I meant a real baseball story.
My girlfriend. That's a real story. I think I would make that up. That embarrassing story.
No, I want a base. That is not a baseball story. That's a heartbreak story.
Oh, well, baseball can be a heartbreaking game. You get three hits and you're good at a 10.
That's a good point. And you're heartbroken seven times. I read
a real baseball story, like a story about the major leagues.
No, just a baseball story. It doesn't have to be about the major leagues. Okay. This has already gone on too long and I regret bringing it up.
I'll tell the story about the time Ryan Terrio made me bleed.
Yes, tell that story. That is a good story. Okay. I read a book. I want to tell you about it real quick. I read a book this past weekend. It's called The Wax Pack. It's by Brad Baluchin. I hope I pronounced that correct. Baluchin, Baluchin. Brad Baluchin. And I want to first say that, I am completely jealous of the concept of the book. It's one of those like, oh, somebody else thought of it moments. We all thought of that. He went and got a 1986 pack of Topps baseball cards, opened it up, and then found the people in it and what they were doing.
Ooh, I like that. That's cool.
And it was really cool.
Very Charlie Pierce of him.
It's just very, it's baseball on the road, and he makes it very personal. At some point in time, it does become a book like a lot of baseball books that touches on fathers and sons, or sons with the absence of fathers and how they become fathers themselves. It touches on that quite a bit. It also has a fascinating for Cardinal fans. It has a fascinating and revealing interview with Gary Templeton, one of the players in the pack of cards that he gets. And he goes and visits Gary Templeton.
All right.
And talks about the whole incident in St. Louis. And should not sit comfortably. I didn't sit comfortably with it. Templeton has some very interesting and some very raw things to say, answer some tough questions in it. So it has this revealing interview with Gary Templeton. And then it also has this revealing non-interview with Vince Coleman, who quite literally gives the writer the runaround. And all I can say is, I've been there, Brad. I can Ophelia. I've had some of those moments. One rather spectacularly with him, and but the lack of an interview actually adds to the story of trying to find him and what the author Brad Bolution does. So it's the Wax Pack. It came out just this past week. It was great. It's great reading for somebody like me, big baseball card fan, big baseball fan, especially because it was at a time that I know those cards. I recognize those cards. I recognize a few of those players. I recognize the fondness that the author had for the player that, you know, was not a star, but was one that he just identified with for no reason. Could be because he had a cool baseball card. Because that's, you know, that was my access to baseball, was buying these Wax Packs and reading in the newspaper, and very rarely seeing games on TV because it just, they weren't available except for Saturdays. So for me, it was both nostalgic and wonderful. And some of the people that he introduces you to, some of the common cards, as we'd call them, the penny cards or dime cards, they have great stories to tell. And, you know, they have great relationships to reveal too, about the people in their lives who help them either get through a baseball career, or more precisely, help them get through life without a baseball career. And it's just fascinating. It was a very, very interesting, very breezy, very, very strong at times, very emotional book that is perfect for people who are missing baseball, even if it's a bit melancholy at times.
I dig it. I'm going to have to read it so I can get advice on how to write about interviews that don't happen, which we might be doing a lot of if this time without games continues.
Yeah, no, I'm keeping a list of books that I'm reading. We could have a book club chat on this podcast.
Oh, I dig it.
Yep. You could, for example, read the Iowa Baseball Confederacy, which is about a game that won't end.
It's kind of like this podcast.
It is kind of like this podcast. You can find the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design, anywhere you get your podcast. Specifically, you can find it on stltoday.com, home of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where the coverage doesn't stop, even though the games have. You can find all of Ben Fredrickson's columns there. He's got a chat every Tuesday at stltoday.com. In the pages of the Post-Dispatch, you can find ongoing Cardinals coverage, including Rick Hummel's series of Where Are They Now? And I will be contributing plenty of content. New to the website today was a draft that Ben and I did that was officiated by the commissioner himself, Rick Hummel, about to kind of test whether or not the Cardinals have the pitching depth that they think they do. It's a topic that we'll definitely explore, but that is up now at stltoday.com. You can also find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. On iTunes, you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes. You can subscribe to the podcast. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make the podcast possible, especially at this distance as we continue to do them every week. You can also rate and review the podcast. I'll admit it, I didn't check it before recording this one, but I will check it immediately after. I try to keep tabs on that because it's the community that makes this podcast possible. So we try to be receptive to the advice of the community, including those who, thank you, have offered me lots of advice as to how to correct some of the audio on here. Trust me, I'm working on it. I know it sounds like sometimes, though I don't think it will this time, fingers crossed, that there was one recently that sounded like we were talking to each other from tin cans, you know, connected by garden hose, not even string, garden hose. And I'm trying to work with the tech that I got from the distance that I have to make this sound good. So let me tell you one last time about our sponsor. Get organized with Closet by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closet by Design, the official sponsor of the weekly best podcast in baseball. We've told them what you're going to tell us the next time you're on, Ben Fredrickson. We will try to stitch together a writer's block reunion. I think I can pull that off. I am not sure who will play point guard for that, so that we don't all talk over one another.
It'll be just like old times then.
See, you didn't even let me finish.
I'm getting ready.
All right. Just gonna, go wait, ahead. Do you want to do the sign off? No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
For the best podcast in baseball. That's St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist Ben Fredrickson. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Stay healthy out there, everyone, please, and we will talk to you soon. So you hide a reference to don't go chasing waterfalls into how many columns?
Oh, I don't know that I should say. If people who know, know. I'll just leave it at that.
That's like me with the Easter eggs that I tuck into stories, like different little puns or allusions.
Yeah, I mean, we all have things that keep us sane, right?
Oh, yeah, we have to. Trent and I talked about this last time. Eventually, you have to write to entertain yourself, because if you can't even entertain yourself, how can you entertain a reader?
Exactly. Exactly. So,
that wasn't a rhetorical question, Ben. How can you entertain a reader?
I don't. I just try to overwhelm them.
You should. You just drop don't go chasing waterfalls lyrics.
Yeah. And do a column about Reed Nicko. And if you can find it, enjoy it. I'll leave it there.
I think we're all supposed to just get along right now.
I'm not seeing anybody. I'm getting along great with everyone. I tend to only get...
that's pretty good.